Good morning. So last time we talked about some additional optimization topics, focusing most of our time on the consequences of out-of-order execution. So we talked about how the kind of high-level view of what a modern processor does, which can fetch multiple instructions per cycle and execute multiple instructions per cycle, and which tries to find work to do based on what operands are available. So we have this idea that we have this instruction queue, this list of available instructions, and we just pull them off and put them onto what we call functional units or execution units as soon as we had work to do. And based on that, we have this idea of a data flow model, that we could reason about the performance of our programs by thinking of them as a graph of operations linked by dependencies between the operations, where dependency means generally that we need the result of one to start the other. And based on this, we have this concept of a latency bound, that when we're executing some program or some function or some loop, we need to finish the longest dependency chain. And this is what's going to determine our performance in a sense. The sense is that assuming that we have enough parallelism in our processor that we never have a case where we have lots of instructions ready to run, but we can't run all of them, then that's exactly how fast we can run. And based on this, we had this idea for speeding up loops where we do some repeated operation like summing a value, where we have these accumulators. And these created a problem for our latency bound because we had this long chain, and we could make those chains shorter by having multiple accumulators, that in the case of like adding up values, we added up into two values, sum them at the end, and now our longest dependency chain was basically half the length. And this was significantly faster on a modern processor, assuming we had enough parallelism available, because we had that shorter dependency chain, even though we had a little extra work to add up the multiple accumulators at the end and get our same result. We also talked about a few miscellaneous optimization topics. So we talked about how compilers optimize dividing by a constant and multiplying by a constant, which I mentioned primarily because you just need to give the compiler enough information to do this. And we talked about how compilers try to reuse address calculations in loops. So the strategies that they generate, which I mentioned partly so you could recognize that you might have performance differences based on whether or not the compiler does this, and so you know how to do it by hand or at least understand what your compiler's doing. So before we go on to our next topic, which we started briefly last time, which was vector instructions, any questions on any of these topics? Okay. So we talked about vector instructions. We have these registers that hold multiple values at once. So we have these 128-bit registers in x86-64. As we'll talk about later, there's more variations of this, but basic idea is we have some big registers which we can treat as multiple distinct values. We could interpret this as one big 128-bit value, but most of the instructions that are provided are going to say this is really an array of values that takes up 128 bits in total. And we have these instructions that act on all the values in the registers, and our processors usually provided ALUs which do those operations on all those values basically as fast as doing, say, operations on RAX and RBX, on normal 64-bit registers which we don't think of as containing an array of values. And I gave one example of a vector instruction. This is PADD. This adds arrays of 32-bit values, where each array, since it's a 128-bit register, has four values, and it adds them pairwise. And this pairwise idea is going to be the form of most of our vector instructions. Mostly they're going to say, you have two arrays of values, I'm going to act on every pair between two registers. So in this case, we can think of the pairs as being vertical. We take 1 and 5 together, 2 and 6, 3 and 7, 4 and 8. the same index from each of the vectors. This is the form almost all the instructions that are provided are going to take. We'll see some exceptions, but for the most part, this is what processor is providing. And because this add instruction takes essentially the same amount of time to execute as, say, adding two 32-bit registers and does four times as much work, it should produce much faster code if you can use it. So for example, I have this carefully written add function, and what it's doing is it's summing up the values from B and adding them to the array A. And this is carefully written, so you notice I've done several things to make sure that my compiler can generate this code that uses these vector instructions. So one thing I did is I used that restrict keyword, and this is one of the few cases I have ever seen the restrict keyword do something. So the compiler I used to compile this, which was I think a recent version of Plane probably, with higher optimization settings, said, okay, so I know those don't conflict, because if they do, there's a dependency issue. So I know, for example, that when I'm adding to A, I know that that means I'm not also manipulating B. They aren't part of the same array. If they were part of the same array, then what the compiler did to compile this is wrong. But fortunately, the compiler knows that's not the case. So you notice the first thing it did here is it's loading four elements from A and four elements from B at a time. And in order to know that that's safe to do, as far as reordering the memory accesses like that, it needs to know that A and B don't overlap. And I've told it that with the restrict keyword. If I didn't, to generate code like this, it would generate some comparison to say, make sure these don't overlap. I also have a fixed loop size, so it knows that, oh, it's a multiple of four, so I don't need to handle any leftover. And so what it does is it has a loop where it goes through the array 16. The array is 16 bytes at a time, accessing four elements, so 16 bytes, 128 bits at a time. So it loads 128 bits from A, loads 128 bits from B, then it adds the pairs of values in those 128 bits. So that's four pairs of values using this instruction I just showed you, to get a result into XMM0, so that 128-bit register, and then it stores that back in A. And then it increments its offset into the arrays, so RAX is an offset that it's keeping in bytes rather than keeping I in terms of number of ints, but it's the same idea, and it also checks whether it's done, whether it's reached 128. In terms of the offset, that's why it's comparing to 512 and not 128. So any questions about this assembly code that my compiler generated? Yes?
Can you add like half the numbers in the vectors? For example, like that five elements, can you add the first three?
So the question is, what if I didn't have 128 here and I had some leftover? Can I deal with that with these instructions? And the answer to a first approximation is no. So there's some more recent, there's some versions of vector instructions which try to support that well. I was about to say they were more recent, but that's wrong. There are processors from the 90s which did this well, but the version of the Intel instructions that uses the XMM registers are not one of them. So for them, if you had some leftover, you'd need to write some code which probably didn't use the vector registers. And if you see compilers generate this sort of code or people write it by hand, they'll have just like we had for loop unrolling, they'll have a little extra code that handles the leftover that uses the slower technique because we can't use those add for instructions. At least we can't use the store for, because we'll overwrite memory we're not supposed to. So what this vector add is doing, we're taking the two values from the two arrays with move DQU, putting them into the vector registers, using PID to get our result. And we can think of this as adding the result values vertically. So it's performing four adds vertically. That's what that loop does. Okay. And as I said, compilers sometimes figure this out. And I showed you earlier, when we were talking about cache blocking, that I had to optimize my loop before cache blocking mattered a lot on the smaller sizes. And the optimization the compiler did was actually using these vector instructions. And it used a form of the vector instructions where it could fit 8 elements per vector. And that's why we have these wiggles here, which happen to be spaced by 8. So the little rise is because the compiler generated code to handle the leftover on each row, and that time to handle the leftover when it wasn't a multiple of 8 decreased the performance significantly. And that's what each little spike is. So it's handling exactly that leftover because there wasn't a form of the vector instructions to say, I don't want to use all of this vector. So that's what the compiler generates. And the way these are executed generally is that on modern processors, typically the ALUs actually look like this. These even most of the normal ALUs. So we have something where we can split up the ALU possibly into different numbers of what we call lanes. And each lane is one of those columns of our vector operation. And we just have them all in parallel. So we just made a whole lot of extra hardware to support these vector instructions quickly. There are ways of implementing it where we don't do this, but on modern processors, typically, if they support 128-bit vector, they have ALUs which can do 128 bits worth of math at the same speed as everything else. And it kind of just looks like this sort of picture where they just duplicated parts of the ALU more than they would have otherwise. Otherwise, it works the same. And in fact, the ALU is probably still pipelined. So you notice here I have an ALU with 3 pipeline stages. So I can start a new vector instruction every cycle. Each of the vector instructions adds 4 values. So with pipelining combined with our vector instructions, we're doing 12 times the work we would do with a sort of naive. We have an ALU which needs to spend 3 cycles and can't do anything else, and also does 1 value at a time. And also, because this is pipelined and it's going to be executed by our out-of-order processor, all the other optimizations we talked about, like loop unrolling and multiple accumulators, still apply. It's just that they're applying on these little arrays rather than single values. They all still apply and are still going to help performance, in addition to the performance gain we have from using these extra lanes, which on a modern processor, typically, you're basically just only using lane 1 if you don't use the vector instruction. So you're just throwing away performance. And you might say, OK, this is a simple implementation, but is this really worth it? Like, that's a lot of extra hardware for these vector instructions, which we know that normal programs don't use most of the time. So why would it be worth adding all this extra hardware versus, say, adding more normal ALUs? Why would you want to add an ALU like this where we have all these lanes rather than just having, instead of 4 ALUs, like 20 normal ALUs that we can execute from our instruction queue as instructions are available? What might be a reason for that? What's a benefit of this approach? Why have all the processor manufacturers decided this is what to do instead of adding more ALUs? No volunteers with a guess. So if we think about when we had our instruction queue, that's a lot of complicated logic to figure out what instructions are ready and also to forward values between the instructions. So even though we think of the ALU as like where the real work of the processor is, as we learned when we implemented pipelining, there's a whole lot of logic that isn't doing any real arithmetic. And this is even more true in these out-of-order processors. We have all this logic not dedicated to the computation. And if you want to make use of more ALUs without something like vector instructions, we're going to need to have a bigger instruction queue because we want to have more instructions ahead that were using ALUs. We're going to have a bigger reorder buffer to collect those results and deal with branch mispredictions. We're going to have a bigger instruction fetch because we want to fetch more instructions per cycle in order to fill all those ALUs. We're going to have more complicated branch prediction because of that. So vector instructions are really attractive to processor manufacturers because you can add vector instructions and add more ALUs that do more work that I, as a programmer, care about without adding all this extra control logic. To add that those lanes to the ALUs, I just added a new kind of instruction that, as far as the instruction queue is concerned, basically looks like a normal add. And I didn't need to add any special control logic compared to if I wanted to actually make use of like three times the number of normal ALUs that were executing different instructions each time, because I need to keep track of all those different instructions, all the branches related to it, all the forwarding of values I need to do. So adding vector instructions lets us do more things at once without adding that much control logic. And so that's why modern processor manufacturers have been more and more aggressive about supporting vector instruction. So, you know, back in the thousands, they were like doing 64-bit vectors, and there's talk of like new processors having like 512 or 1024-bit vectors. So even wider ALUs, maybe more vector registers. This is a trend because it's a way to add capacity to your processor, which doesn't add all this control logic, and that programmers and compilers can take advantage of. The disadvantage, of course, is that the programmer and or the compiler needs to actually use these vector instructions for this to be useful. It's more work for you, the programmer, and your compiler to actually make this extra capacity be used. So, any questions before I move on about this notion of saving on control logic? Okay, so I talked about compilers taking advantage of this. And I showed you some examples where compilers, hey, they figured out how to use vector instructions. And compilers have been getting better and better at this. Like, it used to be that compilers would basically never generate these instructions. If you wanted them, you probably were writing assembly or something like that. And they've gotten better and better at them, but it's very fickle. Compilers are easily messed up by aliasing, because remember they were loading four values at once instead of one. That's changing the order of loads, so they need to worry about, is that value I'm loading ahead of time, would that have been overwritten? And that's often very hard to figure out. They need to worry about like conditionals. If you think of having a loop where we do something like where we have a for loop and we have if A and else something else, well, now all of a sudden it's much harder to use a vector instruction because if this is a plus equals and this is a minus equals, well, I can't just turn this loop easily into use the add instruction because sometimes I want to subtract. And our instruction does the same thing to every element. So that's hard for the compiler to turn into vector instructions. And we rely on like the particular operation we want to use having a vector instruction. So for example, there's no, on say x86-64, there is no vector integer division instruction. If you want to do an integer division with values in vector registers, you're gonna have to move them out into a normal register, run a divide instruction for each one, and then put them back. Okay. So the other thing is that the heuristics that compilers use to figure out vector instructions, they're basically, they have some pattern in mind. They look for some pattern, some generalized version, and know how to turn that into vector instructions. And that pattern is often not intuitive to you as a programmer what happens. And I find it very hard to predict if I write code if the compiler will generate vector instructions or not. So for example, this top loop here, where the inner loop is on J, GCC 7.2 and 5, if you turn on to like optimization level 3, will generate vector instructions. For the bottom version, they won't, because of the different loop orders. It's not that you can't generate vector instructions for the bottom version, but the compiler doesn't figure out how to do that, even though you might say, oh, we have, we're using k here. These k's are right after each other. That should be a good candidate for using vector instructions. They don't figure out how to do it. It's definitely possible to do so and get a performance benefit. And this is because they're doing this sort of pattern matching. And if they haven't written a pattern for what you're doing that matches it, the patterns are like pretty general, but they're not super general. They don't figure it out. And probably what's happening here is they see, gosh, I'm summing into a single place. I don't have a way of figuring out how to do that and turn that into vector instructions. So sorry, I'm just going to generate my normal code. And there are other oddities you can discover if you like try to play with generating vector instructions. So for example, Clang 5.0.0, when I tried it, generated vector instructions for the top code and not the bottom code. And the only change is whether n is an int or a long. Like, probably a bug, but this is a consequence of the compilers using heuristics to figure out, can I turn this into vector instructions? They don't have like some systematic always works way. And this is one of the reasons why I'm teaching about vector instructions, because not only do you want to understand what code is my compiler generating, if you want to get good performance in practice, you might need to do the work your compiler should have done. Like, yes, you can fiddle around and see when your compiler generates good code, but sometimes you're just going to need to take it into your own hands. And so, if the compiler can't figure it out, you have basically two options. The obvious option is, well, you can just write the assembly with these instructions by hand. That's awfully annoying, but like, maybe you have to do that. There's a second option, which is kind of in between, which is that there's something we're going to call intrinsic functions, which are C functions which are going to compile into particular instructions. So these are basically C functions that wrap a particular instruction. And the compiler knows they're special, so it's going to like not never generate a function call. They're always inlined all the time. And in this way, you can tell the compiler very explicitly, this is how you can use vector registers to run this loop. So you can say, you should load 4 values at a time by saying writing the intrinsic function, which corresponds to that move 128 bits. You can say, I want to add 4 pairs of 32-bit values by using the function that corresponds to that PADD instruction. And this way, you can still use all your C support for, say, accessing elements of an array, rather than figuring out how to do that in assembly and dealing with like caller and callee saved registers and all that fun stuff, which I'm sure you found annoying during the loop lab for anyone who had anything ever not work. And Intel, it turns out, defines a set of intrinsic functions. So for the smooth homework and this lab next week, we are going to use Intel's functions, which they have defined as compiler should provide these functions to use our instructions. You can imagine that other architectures might provide different functions, or someone who wants to support multiple architectures might try to find like a generic set like that works across, you know, like x86 and ARM. We're going to use Intel's because they're supported on our live machines and available. I would note that Intel has made some unfortunate design choices. in how they have chosen to name their intrinsic functions and the corresponding types. So I'm going to show you an example, and yes, it's ugly. So generally, Intel uses names which start with underscores for all of their stuff, for some reason. I guess they're worried about using a name you already used. And they use, for the functions we'll be using, there are other sets of functions that aren't supported on our lab machines. For functions we'll be using, all the names of functions start with underscore mm, and all the names of types that we'll use, types that represent a vector register value, start with underscore underscore m. So we have these types here. So we have this special underscore underscore m128i type. And this is a type which means 128 bits worth of integers of some size. So this represents a value that can be stored in one of those 128-bit registers, and we're saying that that value is probably integers. It doesn't say what size of integer it is, just says it's integers. As a minor caveat, I note that you will not get a syntax error if you do A values of 0, but you shouldn't do it because you don't know what type of array it's being treated as. Like, because M128i could mean it's 8-bit value, 8-bit integer 16, 32, or 64, and it chooses some default, I believe it's 32, which might not be what you want. So you should use intrinsic functions, which you can look up if you want to extract parts of it directly. We'll show you some examples of doing that, probably. Or in this, at least we'll have some in the lab. I don't think I have many in the slides beyond the sort of technique we have here, which is also valid. So we have these special types. Note that when we're loading values, we use a cast to this type, and that's because the load function, which represents the move instruction, takes a pointer to that type, so you can cast your array type to a pointer to that type, and we're just going to interpret that address as a 128-bit value to move into a register. So this means that since we have an array, in this case, of integers, that we're going to have the 32-bit value at AI, followed by the next 96 bits, which is the value at AI plus 1, AI plus 2, AI plus 3, and all of that together gets loaded into A values, which hopefully is stored in the 128-bit register. You'll notice that these functions, in addition to starting with underscore mm, have this weird opaque postfix, and that's telling you actually about the type of the function. So in this case, they have the postfix SI128, and that means 128-bit integer value. That's just a type indicator for the functions. For the load functions, it doesn't really matter. All we care about that is that it's 128 bits. For example, there's a version of the load functions for, you know, two doubles. You could use that in the place of this with the appropriate cast, and that would be fine, because it's still loading 128 bits. We don't actually care what type it is, because it's going to generate the same kind of assembly. There's also a U here on both this load and store. And the U means unaligned. So otherwise, the pointer addresses must be a multiple of 16. And by must be, I mean if they aren't, you'll get a seg fault. So we'll always use the unaligned versions just to avoid that problem. Also, we'll use them because the aligned versions are not faster on the machines we care about. There are machines where they are faster, not the ones we care about. It is faster if your address is a multiple of 16, regardless of which version you use, because that means that we don't have to access two cache blocks, everything's in one. Okay. So we also have this add function. So it starts with our prefix underscore mm, and it has add, and it has this postfix EPI32, And that means that's our postfix, meaning 432-bit integers. So all the functions that deal with the 128-bit values as 432-bit integers are going to end with EPI 32. So there's some multiply functions that deals with those. It's going to end with EPI 32. And you'll also be able to guess based on this, if I have a different size, what the name will be. Yes?
Does EPI specifically just mean
4? So EPI, what does EPI stand for? EPI stands for extended packed integers. So at least that's my best guess. So there was an earlier version of this API which used 64-bit registers. So presumably they called those just packed integers, and now it's 128-bit, so they call them extended packed. And that's where the name comes from. But for example, we'll see in the next slide that there's EPI 64, and that's two 64-bit integers. It's still 128 bits of stuff. Okay, so I guess I'll take a note on, so I said that you should not do A values of zero because that might not do what you expect. So there's an intrinsic that that I think we have listed in our reference for the lab called MMExtract for getting a particular value like an array, which turns into an instruction that does that. The other alternative is, well, here I'm storing the values from sums, which is my 128-bit thing, into an array. After I do that, I can just read the array to find out what those values were. So if you want the most obvious, definitely works way of extracting things from one of these vector registers, just make an array as a local variable, store into it, and access the array elements. So that's one way you can do that. Here, we're storing it into the array because that's where our result goes. We're implementing A plus AI plus equals. So as I alluded to, we can do this with different size values. So here, instead of having 32-bit values, I have 64-bit values. And I made some changes. So one change, of course, is that my arrays are not arrays of ints, but arrays of longs. Another change is that each iteration of this loop, where I load 128 bits, is processing two array elements, so I increment I by 2, not 4 like I was doing before. And the other change is that I don't use EPI 32 version of the function, I use EPI 64. And the difference here is that this is going to produce an instruction P add DQ, I believe, whereas the EPI 32 version produced P add D. So these are different instructions. There happens to be different instructions, yes, for every size value you can interpret the vector as. So that's kind of a disadvantage of this design, is that to support it, Intel added a lot of instructions. Because if you just want to support add, subtract, multiply, well, now we need like 4 versions of each of them. Okay. So any questions about this code? Yes?
It's still, IP64 is still 464-bit
values. The question is EPI 64 is still 464? No, it's two. Oh, it's PID, yeah. It's two 64-bit integers. So the rule is that these M128i is always 128 bits. So it's always 128 bits. So whenever we have an instruction dealing with them that deals with more than one value, should be dealing with all 128 bits worth of stuff. You're probably easier to just think of EPI as an arbitrary thing, because the reason its name makes sense is only because there's this historical version of these instructions that use 64-bit registers. Okay, so now that we know what these intrinsics look like, let's look at how we would apply them to a problem which is maybe a little less trivial. So here, the function we started out with is pretty simple, right? And it's pretty obvious how we can use add pairs of values together. Often, it's not going to be so obvious how to do that. And let's take, for example, our square function. Let's say, what was the compiler doing to use vector instructions for this? So usually, when you want to turn something to use vector instructions, first, you want to expose working in sets of the appropriate size. We want to work with 128 bits of values at a time, at least, because that's the size we could load into a vector register. And here, if I have unsigned ints, that means I have 32 bits, so I want to work on 4 unsigned ints at once. So what I'm going to do to expose working on 4 unsigned ints at once is first I'm going to unroll it 4 times. So this is one way where now I have 4 operations together, and these are, it turns out, independent operations. So fortunately, these don't depend on each other. I could just unroll a loop, and I could do these in any order. And that's good, because what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn each part of these lines into a vector instruction that does all 4 of these lines together. So basically, my goal is that I want to use the add for 32-bit values instructions to do the plus equals, and I want to use some sort of multiply for 32-bit values to do the times. Like, there are instructions that do that, add 4 values into 4 pairs of values and multiply 4 pairs of values. I want to use those 2 instructions to implement these computations. And the tricky part is going to be lining up the arguments to that to have my vector of 4 copies of the same value of aik and consecutive values here and consecutive values here. So for the consecutive values, we know we can just load 128 bits from B and from A to get those. So for the consecutive values, we just load 128 bits, then store 128 bits. Because they happen to be adjacent in the array. We know because it's j plus 0, j plus 1, j plus 2, they're just right next to each other in memory, so we can use that 128-bit load and store instruction. If we had something else where it was like I plus 0 times n, I plus 1 times n, we'd be in a little bit more trouble. Like, we can't directly load that. We need to do separate loads and like put them together, and that would be actually a lot slower and harder. But luckily, because of the loop order I chose, I can do each of these as just read 128 bits, and I get the 4 elements I care about because they happen to be together. But we also have to multiply by the same value from A every time. So we somehow have to load into our 128-bit register 4 copies of a 32-bit value. Now, this sort of pattern, it turns out, comes out a lot. And because of that, there is an intrinsic function that Intel has implemented that will do exactly that. There's a function, it's called set1epi32. You pass a 32-bit value, and it loads 4 copies of it into a 128-bit value. And the instructions this corresponds to varies a little bit, but there's a short sequence of instructions to do this. We'll talk a little later about instructions for manipulating things within a vector, which it turns out we need for some things. But for now, we just have to know this is so common that Intel has made sure that there's a convenient way of doing it. We also need to know how to multiply, and it turns out that the multiply instruction is called, intrinsic is called molo epi32 is the one we want. It multiplies 4 pairs of 32-bit values and gives the lowest 32 bits of the results. So that's what the low stands for. There's a high, which gives the upper 32 bits of a 64-bit result. And there's one without a lower high, which multiplies 2 32-bit values and gives you 64-bit results. And this corresponds to an instruction called P PMOL LD, L for low, D for 32-bit. Okay, so given that we know these intrinsics, let's work on vectorizing square. And I'm just going to work through piece by piece what is this going to turn into, and then we're going to combine that back together into a piece of code which actually works. So to start out, let's talk about how am I going to deal with this access to B. So I'm going to need to do two things to implement that, because we both read B and write B. So first, I'm going to load for elements from B. So I'm passing the address of this first array element, and I know the other three array elements are right after it in memory. So I can use this 128-bit load instruction to load all of them together. And I'm going to store them in a variable I'm calling bij, which is going to have that underscore underscore m128i type to represent 128 bits of integers. So I'm loading 128 bits worth of integers into bij. Then at some point, I'm going to manipulate bij as a variable. And I'm going to store that result back after I've added this whole thing to it, back where I started with the corresponding store instruction. That's just basically the opposite. So I'm going to write back exactly where I read from. Questions about this part? Okay. Similarly, I have to load the values from AI k times n plus j plus 0. These also happen to be right next to each other in memory, so I'm just going to do one load instruction that loads 128 bits, which is going to be those four values into my vector, into my little array of four values. And then I need to multiply that times aik. So we talked about having this set one, so intrinsic. So I'm going to take ai times n plus k, and I'm going to use this function to turn it into a vector of four copies of that value. And I'm also going to load, as before, akj. So what I end up with here is I have akj 0, comma akj 1, comma akj 2, akj j 3. So basically, I have k plus 1 plus 2 plus 3. That's what I load into akj, and I'm multiplying that times four copies of aik. And we just do this column-wise, so we have akj 0 times aik, akj 1 times aik, and so on. And that's what ends up in what I'm calling multiply results here. So finally, we have the step of actually taking those results of the multiplication and adding them to bij. We already saw the add four pairs of values instruction in intrinsic, so we're going to use that, and then we're going to add it into bij, that local variable, which remember that we already said that we're manipulating it, and then storing it back in the original array. So when you put it all together, you get something like this. So any questions about this code? And so this is essentially what my compiler, in this case, figured out how to do automatically when I provided aggressive enough optimization options. So there are some other types of operations besides these add, do things with pairs of values that are important. And one of them, which is a bit confusing, are things known as shuffles or sometimes swizzles, which is basically, let's rearrange the values in a vector. And we need this because, well, our alternative, the only way we know of rearranging the values in a vector, is to store it into an array in memory and then rearrange that array with slow one-by-one instructions and then write it back in a vector. And that's pretty inefficient. So, for example, there's this shuffle intrinsic, which uses this funny macro which produces a special integer constant, which can, say, take this array of values. This set R just says, give me a constant vector. So this takes 10, 20, 30, 40, and this rearranges it to 20 index 1, 10 index 0, 40 index 3, 30 index 2. Yes, it's in the wrong order. I know. That is actually what happens. Intel likes writing things in order from highest address first, which is why there's an R in this set, by the way, because the other version of set is in the reversed order, but that stores in memory not in the order you'd probably expect. And there's also, say, a version of this, oh, I wrote this wrong on the slides, 8, that deals with bytes. So here I have an array of 16 bytes, and there's this version where I specify, I want the first index here to be index 2, that's 30, the second one to become from 2, which is 30, and that's what I, and so on, and that's what I get in my results. So I just specify, basically, look up index 2, 2, 2, 2 of the input vector, then 3, 3, 3, 3, and put them in those, the corresponding slots of the result vector. So there's a bunch of operations like this. There's a whole bunch of variations and special cases of these rearranged values in a vector. I don't expect you to memorize any of them. I'm just telling you they exist, so you can look up the documentation when you need to figure out, gosh, I have A, B, C, D in a vector, and I really would prefer to have A, D, C, B. How do I do that? You can figure it out when you need to figure it out. But there are instructions to do this, and this is another sort of complication of having vector instructions, is that for many useful operations, you need to provide these, let's just rearrange values in a vector, which with normal registers, you don't. There's also some instructions for other types of manipulation like that, like combining values from different vectors into one vector, adding values or doing arithmetic on values within one vector rather than between pairs between two vectors, and extracting parts of vectors into normal registers. Like, these are all operations we might want to do in ways which are less annoying than what we have to do by like storing things to memory and using non-vector instructions. Okay, so I would briefly note that there are ways other than intrinsic functions in assembly that you might access vector instructions. So for example, GCC has vector extensions that look more like normal C code. Like, I have types, different types for each kind of vector, and like you write plus and it tries to do it. I haven't used GCC's extensions, so I don't know if they produce good code. But like, that's an idea which is less tied to particular instructions like Intel's extensions are, not surprisingly, because Intel wants you to use Intel processors, probably. Also, CUDA, and generally programming interfaces for GPUs, have a way of accessing vector instructions that looks more like writing multi-threaded code. But each thread really is a lane of the vector, is one column. GPUs generally support some extra kinds of vector instructions to make this support most types of code you'd write, which is not the case for the types of vector instructions supported on my laptop processor, for example. And I guess I would note that we talked about vector instructions with respect to normal processors, but GPUs essentially are processors with very, very aggressive vector instructions. So first approximation, that's what makes a GPU fast. So another note. So we talked about and I showed these vector instructions that use 128-bit registers. These are called SSE with various numbers depending on the version. And those are supported in the lab machines. Later processors from Intel support a second set of instructions called AVX, which have 256-bit registers. So those are obviously going to be faster. The reason we're not using them is that if you SSH into lab Unix 01, you have a machine which can't run them. Otherwise, I would have showed you the AVX instructions, which are a little nicer. Also, other ISAs have them. So I showed you like x86. ARM has their own set of vector instructions called Neon. MIPS has one called MSA. PowerPC, which like was used for the Wii, for example, has AltaVec and VMX, which are all versions of these vector instructions. And so I showed you that there are other support instructions you might have besides just pairs of arithmetic, like moving things around in vectors. Vector instruction sets that aren't Intel's, especially ones for like GPUs or for processors that otherwise are really built around, I only care about vector instructions, often have these features that require more hardware but make it a lot easier to write vector programs. And these are slowly creeping in to normal processors. I don't know how many of them will make it there because they do make the hardware more complicated. So one example, as I mentioned, conditionals are really annoying. I can't like add only sometimes. My add instruction is always add four values. I can't like add one, three, and four. It's not an option. So there are instructions to the instructions you can add to make those conditionals easier to handle. GPUs have them. There's extensions to make variable length vectors a thing. So if I have a vector of 16 values and I only care about the first 12, that's really annoying. With Intel style instructions, there are extensions where you can specify, I only care about the first 12 values, thank you. And also loading and storing. So when we did our load and store of Square, we needed to like make sure things were together in memory or else things didn't really work. If we had a different loop order, that would be really awkward. But sometimes processors provide instructions which load and store values that aren't contiguous, like values which are separated by n. Obviously, supporting that is a lot more complicated in hardware, because that's like a bunch of cache accesses. It's a lot harder to implement. But it's worth it because it makes a lot more code easy to write with vector instructions. Okay. So, as I mentioned, Smooth, our second performance assignment, we're going to have you use vector instructions. So the main task in Smooth is that you're taking the average of every 3x3 block of pixels in an image. And pixels are 4 1-byte values put together. They're 1-byte values, but your computations are going to be done with shorts because to take the average exactly, you're going to have a sum which is bigger than 256 a lot of the time. So you need vectors of 16-bit values is how you're going to do the computation. And the big thing you're going to take advantage of is that if I have, you know, this computation to do the average where I add up each of the pixel components separately, I can just do that with one vector instruction. I can do each of the pixel 0 red plus pixel 1 red and pixel 0 green plus pixel 1 green. I can do all of those together with one vector instruction, provided I've loaded pixel 0 into one of these MM128i's and pixel 1 into another. You may notice that if we're working with shorts, we're not using all of 128-bit vector. That's not really a problem, but obviously if you do use it, you get better performance. Okay, so that's all I'm probably going to say about Smooth. So I'm going to have a brief diversion to talk about optimizing programs. So we've talked about a bunch of techniques for making programs faster, and we have performance assignments where we're saying, make this function fast. When you have a real program and you're told, make this program fast, that's not the form of problem you have. You have a program which has like 10,000 lines, and you want to spend your time optimizing the function which matters. If your program spends 90% of its time reading files, it doesn't really matter how much work you spend on making its computation faster. It's probably not getting faster to visibly faster. And you know, if you guess, well, that this computation is probably really slow, let's optimize that. But really, it's somewhere else that the program's spending its time. That's a waste of your time. And in practice, programmers are pretty bad at guessing where their program is spending their time. So we generally recommend that if you have a real program, use a tool to determine where your program's spending its time. And there's lots of tools for this. They're called profilers. So on Linux, there's a profiler called perf, P-E-R-F. And I mean only on Linux. This does not exist in OS X. You have a different set of profilers in OS X. So perf is what's known as a sampling program profiler. So what it does is it runs your program, and periodically it stops it and sees what's happening. And by doing this enough, we can get some idea of where your program's spending its time, statistically speaking. Obviously, this has the disadvantage that we could not see your program in a function at all, even if it's executed a lot, if we just get unlucky with when we take our samples. But it has the advantage of that this is a pretty efficient way to implement a profiler versus if you actually recorded like every function call. And the basic uses of perf is that you run, there's a record command where you run the program, and then there's a report or annotate command which shows you where you're spending your time. And to give a very concrete example, let's say hypothetically I wanted to optimize my HTLRS. So HTLRS, if I say run it on some long number of cycles, it takes a while. Pretty long while to run 2 million cycles. A really long while. You know, so I might say, well, so how can I make this, you know, so this is pretty slow, you know, even if I run for only, you know, a million cycles, it's quite slow. So how could I make this faster? You know, let's do it for the number of cycles which terminate. So I can record what happens when I run that. Unfortunately, I didn't run for very long and I didn't get many samples. Let's be a bit more aggressive. So I run that for a while, taking a bunch of samples. So it says it got 81 samples of my program. And I can use this report interface. And so what this tells me is it gives me the name of a functions where I spent my time. And it has two columns, children and self. So self means when I took the sample, this was the current function executed. Children means when I took the sample, either this function was executing or something this function called was executing. So for example, main, my main function, which has a funny name because this is Rust, my main function has 100% of samples. That's because I was always in something that was called from main. But it has 0% self because I was never actually in main itself when we took a sample. Okay. And we can see some function here. So here, this is something called spanned expression evaluate. And we can see 66% of my samples, I was in that function. And 100% of my samples, I was in that function or something called by it. And we can see that the something called by it was HashMap default hasher. So something related to an implementation of a hash table. In that 33% of the time. Okay. So generally, if you want to get a profile, a useful report, you want probably more than 81 samples. So I have one I prepared earlier where I took several hundred samples. And we can see some general patterns here. So one thing we see that, again, evaluate is where most of these samples were. and some of them and, you know, run a program. And within Evaluate, it seems like a lot of our time is spent in things related to our hash table library. And that's probably not an intuitive thing. Why is my run my HCL program spending, you know, like 30% of its time looking up things in hash tables? And the answer is, if I look at my code, I find out, oh, it's probably because I used the name of a wire to look up its value in a hash table. And that's where I'm spending my time. So rather than like optimizing, like let's simplify the expressions or something like that, if I want to make this faster, what I should do is try to turn that like hash table lookup into like an array lookup. Like that's a good, better use of my performance optimization time. And this is probably not something I would have guessed just looking at my code naively. So another feature that this profiler has, which many profilers of this sort have, is it has an annotate feature, where it will show you not just sort of a breakdown of functions, but it will show you, hey, 8.6% of my samples were on this instruction. So when you want to do really micro-level analysis, maybe this will tell you what's going on. To make this useful, you need a lot of samples, and you need to be wary a little bit because of out-of-order execution. When there's multiple instructions running, the sample is going to appear on one of the instructions that's running and not necessarily be distributed across all of them. But this gives you like a very micro level idea at a, you know, more than just a function call. I know that this is implementing these lines of code, as that's where those samples were, not just a particular function. So, any questions about profilers? Yes?
If I look at the profiler, can you find the corresponding assembly into whatever HCL or C file it is?
Can I find the corresponding assembly and...
Like, find it in the C code, HCL code?
Yes. So that's, in fact, what I was seeing when I went here. So this view is showing me assembly instructions interleaved with my original code, which is written in Rust. That's why it looks funny. But it's, yeah, showing me both because I have the debug. I compiled with enough debugging to make that happen. Oops. Okay. So I note that there are other kinds of profilers. So there's another kind of profiler which doesn't sample, but like actually like records every function call. This has the advantage of like telling you exact information. It has the disadvantage of having higher overhead, and in particular, the overhead is not evenly distributed like a sampling profiler. Like a sampling profiler basically messes up your program a fixed number of times a second. This type of profiler messes up every function call. Okay. So that's a note on profilers. So with that, I'm done talking about optimizations. So good luck on the assignments. A note on smooth. So based on early results, I think I probably set the rotate performance requirement lower than I should have. And the smooth one probably isn't set like that. So smooth is probably harder, just to let you know. I said the rotate one was like set conservatively because I changed the numbers this semester. So, you know, I wanted to make sure they were low enough that they were definitely achievable, but I was probably a little too aggressive. Okay, so next topic is going to be about operating system support for in processors. And we're going to talk about two kinds of operating system support. We're going to talk about exceptions and virtual memory. And these are kind of related. And we're going to start with exceptions. And exceptions are about control flow. And to introduce them, let's say I have this program. So here's a program I wrote. It's a great program. And let's say I just run it on a lab machine. Just start running. Just step away, walk away, go home. If I'm doing that, could you use that lab machine still? So who thinks yes? Yes, I could. Okay. Yeah. So a lot of people don't want to volunteer an answer. Even though I hope, yeah, so people who are volunteering answer, who thinks, yes, I could, even if the lab machine has one core. So most people, yes. So something, and that is true. If I run this program on a lab machine, you will still be able to use the lab machine. It might be a little slower for you, but you'll still be able to use it. And this would be true even if the lab machine had one core. And we know that, you know, this means that something else is happening. We aren't just executing this program, we're somehow executing your program, even though I didn't write any instructions to run your program. Like, I just wrote instructions to run this loop. And to get a better idea of what's happening, I have this other version of this program, where instead of just doing nothing, I do some timing. So I get the time, I get the time again, I take the difference, store it in an array, I run this for a long time. And if I'm the only program running, we'd expect on something like our pipeline processor that, well, this should be the same difference each time. It should take basically the same amount of time to fetch the time. There might be a little variation from like caches, but that should go away after the first couple iterations of the loop, especially since like we aren't accessing more data than fits in our cache. It's a tiny loop. You know, all contiguous stored things. So if I run that on a busy system, here's a graph of the results. Sample number at the bottom and the time in nanoseconds on a log scale. And this is on a log scale, so that means that there are 7 orders of magnitude of difference between the samples I have here. So a first notable thing is that there's some times where, you know, we're spending all this time not running my program, apparently. Like, I got the time again, and we spent a huge amount of time relative to like how fast that loop runs. Turns out maybe a couple, you know, tens of milliseconds doing something else. And that something else, well, the hint here is this is a busy system, was running some other program. There are also these shorter delays where we presumably also were running some other program, but just not for as long. And so there needs to be some mechanism in the processor to make that happen. Because if we look at my code, this is my code. So my code, I call getTime, getTime does something, and then I like store the value somewhere, and then I call getTime again, and somehow in the middle of that, even though I didn't write any instructions to do anything special, we have this million cycle delay. So from my point of view, my processor has this very weird performance where sometimes I have these million cycle stalls. It's still a perfectly correct processor. It does everything right. It just sometimes has these really, really long stalls. And what's actually happening is that during that million cycle delay, the operating system snuck in somehow with help from the processor and ran some other things, like maybe my SSH client and Firefox, for example. And then it got back to my loop program. So we're going to talk about the mechanism that the processor provides to make this possible, to make it so I can write code which isn't aware of SSH and Firefox, doesn't want to cooperate with making sure that they get a chance to run, you know, and still have that happen. What's the mechanism the processor uses to do that? And for those of you who did the reading, it's called an exception. So what really happens here is that when I stop running, the operating system runs for a little bit of time. And what it's doing is it's figuring out, okay, I need to run something else now. You've had enough time, loop.exe. And it starts something else. That finishes. The operating system runs for a little bit, then switches to another thing. And so it's running on each of these intervals. And since the operating system runs, something needs to start it. We don't have an instruction to do that. So the mechanism which causes the operating system to run is something we call an exception. So we had an exception happen during our loop.exe, which was some external event in this case, something that I didn't write in my program. And that exception called the operating system. Something a processor implemented called the operating system without an actual call instruction to do so. And then the operating system returned from that exception, that special call, and somehow arranged to return not to loop.exe, but to SSH. So what happens here is we have this mechanism where the OS starts running instead of a normal program. And what the OS does is, well, it started running, so it's going to save the old program counter. So we're going to have that function call sort of usual work of saving a return address. In this case, our return address is where that million cycle delay was. And it's also going to save all my registers somewhere. So note that unlike a function call, I need to save all the registers because I didn't prepare for an exception to happen. I'm just using all my registers as if they're all mine. It's not like a function call where I know I need to save certain registers. So the S needs to save all the registers because I have permission to use all of them. And then it sets new registers and somehow jumps back to return from this exception into ssh.exe. And this whole process is called a context switch. And the name context switch comes from what the saved information, this old program counter and those register values, are called a context. Okay. So our context, what I mean by that, to be even more explicit, is that it includes all the register values, including the stack pointer. It includes the condition codes, because I don't know that this exception is happening. The OS better make sure that if I have, a compare, then an exception happens, and then a conditional jump, that that conditional jump behaves correctly. So the S needs to somehow save and restore the condition codes. And also the program counter. I need to know where to return to, the equivalent of the return address. And if we think about our CPU, this is all the state that I, as a programmer, know exists. Like, yes, there's more things like pipeline registers, but I can't access that as a programmer. This is all the state I can observe. And that's what the OS needs to store somewhere. So it's basically saving the state of the processor I think I have, and then putting it back later, presumably. And so what the OS ends up doing is, basically, we save the PC, we save all the registers into some structure, then we load the values from some place we saved earlier, and then jump to that PC. Conceptually, this is what the OS is doing during that exception event. So what ends up happening is that our CPU, it contains the values for process A, then the OS gets to run, and now it contains the values for process B, and in the OS's memory, we have all this saved context data. So the OS just copies everything in the CPU to its memory, and in fact swaps it with what was in its memory previously for some other program. And I think this is where I'll leave up. So I guess I noticed that I gave you the reading just for exceptions and not for processes. As you can guess, this is part of a process. So that's what the book is referring to when we talk about processes. So we're going to talk about next time about a couple additional topics about how processes work, which is this idea that you seem to think you have your own program that gets to use the CPU and you don't really. And also about exceptions, which are primarily for us, the way of implementing that. That's all I have for today.